The final case on the dock today is Frida Prevel versus Stark County Board of Revision and the Stark County Auditor, case number 99-1010. Mr. Hall.
Thank you, Your Honor. It must be hard for this court to have this issue repeatedly come back time and time again, especially with the court having addressed this issue in March of this year. But the issue is really one that will probably continue to revisit this court until the court either lays a bright line rule that no complaint can be filed with the County Board of Revision unless it's signed by the property owner or by the attorney of record licensed to practice law in the state. In this case, we contend that the Board of Tax Appeals misconstrued and misapplied the court's principles in Worthington City School District and in Sharon Valley to the specific facts of this case. As we read those two decisions by this court, every complaint that is filed with the Board of Tax Appeals must not necessarily be signed by either an attorney at law licensed to practice in this state or by the property owner, but instead, when a complaint is filed by someone other than a lawyer or the property owner, then there must be a determination as to whether or not there is an unauthorized practice of law, and that's really the core issue in this case.
Does an attorney, in fact, or power of attorney, is that a more special, can you argue about that, whether it's a more special relationship than a mere agency?
Well, I think that there is a more special relationship, and it's more than just an attorney, than just an agency relationship, an agent-principal relationship. If we look at, and if we digress, and we look at Revised Code Section 1337.03, it specifically provides, and it addresses the signing of deeds in particular, but 1337.03 states in pertinent part, deeds prepared or signed, or executed, deeds executed under a power of attorney shall be as valid and effectual in all respects as if they had been executed by the principals in person.
This is not a deed, is it?
It's not a deed, but if a person can sell and convey property, if a person can incur liability in mortgages with a valid power of attorney, then there's a special fiduciary relationship existing between the attorney, in fact, and the individual property owner that at least has to be evaluated. And again, it comes back, I'm not arguing to this court that every time a person has a power of attorney, that puts them in the same stead and place of the property owner. I think that must go beyond that to make a determination, as the court laid out in the Sharon Village case and in the Worthington City School Board case, was the agent, was the attorney, in fact, was the person with the power of attorney, in this case, was the nephew, engaged in the unauthorized practice of law?
Frevel. Was she disabled?
As the record indicates, Frida Frevel is 93 years old. She is non-ambulatory. She has periods of lucidity, but many times she still lives in a residence with her nephew and with the help of a full-time health care aide.
Have you reviewed Section 1337.09? I'm looking at subsection C, subdivision. Have you looked at that?
Yes.
And how do you argue that applies here, or?
Well, it does, but I think, that application and, the power of attorney statutes, the competency statutes, and we come back to this, the core issue really here is, was Carl Dorn, the nephew with the power of attorney in this case, engaged in the unauthorized practice of law? And that has to be a combined legal factual analysis before the Board of Tax Appeals throws every case out. I think if we look at least the reported portions of Sharon Village and the reported portions of Worthington City School District, and the cases before that, such as Gupta and others, the Board of Tax Appeals seems to have taken a blanket examination by turning to the complaint and seeing, is it signed by either the titular property owner or by an attorney? If it's not, then there's an automatic dismissal of the case, or at least an argument to show cause. In this case, the arguments were made, and the Board of Tax Appeals did hold its determination until after this court ruled in the Worthington case, and then very shortly thereafter issued its opinion. But we think it was a misapplication, because this case is somewhat more akin to the court's ruling in the in the case of Stein and Ameritech, because there the facts before the case was that, well, an attorney prepared it, but Stein reviewed it and signed it. Well, this is kind of the inverse of that, in that Mr. Dorn reviewed and prepared the file, but Mr. Dorn filled in and completed the form, but then an attorney reviewed it and made the arguments before the Stark County Board of Revision.
Did the attorney review it before it was filed?
The facts in this case indicate that the attorney did not review it before it was filed. But again, there's a three-part analysis, as we know from looking at Sharon Village, and we know from looking at Worthington City Schools, to determine whether or not there was a practice of law. And the focus is, was the document prepared with knowledge that was not possessed by an ordinary layman? Here, in completing a board of a complaint before the Stark County Board of Revision, really it's not. It's a fill-in-the-blank that any individual, in this case, who has access to the tax records can have. You know, were there legal advice and instructions of rights and obligations? Well, clearly that didn't happen, because Mr. Dorn, shortly after filing the complaint and before the hearing was held before the Stark County Board of Revision, contacted counsel. And most importantly, and if we go back and we examine the Sharon Village case, the Worthington case, and so forth, is the real key here is, was there an appearance in the tribunal? Was there a presentation of evidence? Was there a focus in advocating the rights by a layman, which is other than the property owner, or was it done by an attorney? And here, all of the true practice of law was conducted by counsel licensed to practice law in the state.
Are you able to cite any examples of where a person holding a power of attorney was permitted by some court to file a complaint in court? I mean, just tort action.
No, because clearly that is the practice of law. Because if you take that application, filing a complaint in a tort action, filing a complaint in a contract's rights action, is, if you apply the Mahoney...
An owner could do that pro se, couldn't
obviously, an individual...
Or a holder of a claim.
A holder of a claim can always do that on their own. But in this case, Mr. Dorn was really placed at a prejudice, because no one at the Stark County Auditor's Office, no one, when he went to review, informed him, you cannot do this even with a power of attorney. You must either have the property owner sign the complaint, or, in which we know that she cannot do because she was mentally infirm, or you can have an attorney do that. Now, in this case, the record is clear. The complaint was filed on March 30th. Had that bright line rule been laid down by this court, and had the law been very clear to every Board of Revision in every county in this state, you cannot accept for filing any complaint unless it's signed by the property owner or by an attorney of record. Mr. Dorn, and more particularly Frieda Fravel, the property owner, would not have been prejudiced in this issue. There was still sufficient time for him to contact counsel, have counsel do the same thing that was done in the case that was reversed in the Worthington County Board of Revision, basically review the record and either sign it as counsel of record or affirm that it had been reviewed and signed. In this case, though, as we know from the affidavit, as we know from the information in the record, the Stark County Board of Revision gave him the complaint, he filled out the complaint, he signed it, and it was accepted. Our argument in this case is that Mr. Dorn did not engage in a unauthorized practice of law. Mr. Dorn has a special fiduciary relationship, which is different from the other cases. In the other cases, the agent or the person who signed and filed the complaint was either doing it because they were doing it for a fee or for some other monetary compensation. Here, the record and the facts are pretty much uncontested that Carl Dorn stood in the stead of Frieda Fravel, who we know from the record could not do this on her own. Thank you.
Mr. Bridenstine, is it?
Yes.
The issue, as we see it in this case, is where is the line of scrimmage going to be placed with regard to the issue of unauthorized practice of law by people filing for reductions in front of the Board of Revision. Sharon Village is pretty clear. The opinion from Justice Douglas is full of references to the requirements and the consequences of filing a complaint. That particular case can't be faulted except in one particular area. And that, I would point out, is that the statute doesn't say attorney at law. It says the owner or their agent. I suppose an attorney can be an agent for a property owner, but the statute does not say attorney at law per se. So that the universe of agents who could be referred to by the statute may include more than attorney at law. That is not to cast any aspersions on the decision in Sharon Village. It's simply to point out that the line is not as bright as it could be with regard to this issue. The other fact pattern that we see comes out of the Worthington City School District case, in which we have the Ameritech exception. And as Mr. Hall has pointed out, his case, he's trying to position his case to be a little bit more like the Ameritech exception, or in some form of it, that it would escape the prohibition of Sharon Village.
Suggesting that an agent, somebody holding a power of attorney or an attorney in fact might be an agent who could file a complaint for an owner?
I'm suggesting that the issue is whether or not the completion of the complaint form, the act of filling in the form, is truly the practice of law or not. If the filling out, the completion of that form, is the practice of law, then Sharon Village controls and we go home. If it is not the practice of law, then we have everybody coming in, filling out the forms, and then they have to be represented at the BOR hearing.
You know, in Sharon Village, I think what stuck in the craw of the Board of Revision was that an agent, what they call a tax complaint agent, was securing business and then filing.
Absolutely.
Complaint.
And I have been a party to some of those cases representing our Board of Revision, and that is an evil to be avoided and obliterated here.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
Evil's in the eye of the beholder, I suppose.
Well, certainly, when we had a case with Mr. Middleton. You may recall Mr. Middleton out of Cleveland, who came down and without the knowledge of any of the property owners filed complaints for reduction of 12 nursing homes in our county. And he thereafter went to them and said, "Hey, I filed this. Today's the last day. You can't file it for yourself. You're out of time. So you strike a deal with me, and I'll take a cut, and I'll go take your case. And if we win, you can pay me out of your tax savings." We see that as an evil to be avoided. The problem is, if this is not the practice of law, and I think Justice Douglas's opinion in Sharon Village recognized this, we can go get powers of attorney for anybody to fill out this form. And as long as it's done ahead of time, the complainant, the property owner, is possibly properly before the Board of Revision. If we hold the line at the practice of law as being representation of and presentation of the case to the Board of Revision, maybe that's where the line of scrimmage can be. But if we stay where it is now, Mrs. Fravel is out of luck, and her case is not heard. Now, frankly, I don't care about the result of this case. My client does not care about the result of this case. They heard this case on the merits. It went up to the BTA, and the BTA dismissed it for lack of jurisdiction on the unauthorized practice of law issue. Boards of revision, as you know, are political creatures. We have an auditor, a treasurer, and a county commissioner, and they rely on the votes of taxpayers. It is not their in their interest, as they see it, to bounce people out.
The power of attorney, how that does that create a special relationship with the owner, and can you talk about that? Let me first of all say I did a little bit of research, and I came across a 1996 case of this court written by Justice, I believe, Sweeney, In re Estate of Hagel, and that's at 76 Ohio State 3rd, 476. He says, in comparing guardians and attorneys in fact, he says the guardians are appointed by the probate court and are subject to the court's control, whereas attorneys in fact have much more freedom and can act without court approval as the principal's alter ego. What can you respond to that?
I have to decline to make up anything. I'm not prepared to speak to that distinction at this point.
Well, can you talk about what a person holding a power of attorney can do and not do on behalf of the principal?
Well, I can speak certainly to what they cannot do. Mr. Hall has mentioned the ability to convey property and sign deeds and the mortgage property and so forth. I don't think Mr. Hall would go so far as to say that an attorney, in fact, can actually draft those instruments. They can execute them. They can exercise the judgment to either mortgage the property or convey the property, because that's properly within the power of attorney that's granted. But I would think that they would be engaging in unauthorized practice of law to prepare those documents. And I think you ask what an attorney in fact cannot do. I think they cannot prepare those things under the power of attorney. And the Sharon Village case seems clearly to say that the completion of this complaint form is one of those things that an attorney in fact cannot do.
How could Mrs. Favelle file this complaint?
Well, Mr. Dorn would have had to sought out the advice of an attorney at law and had it signed and filed by the attorney. Now,
there's a point where that's not economic.
Sure it is. I agree. And that brings us back then to the issue. Is this a practice, is billing out and completion of this form, is it the practice of law or not? And that's why I have focused on simply the completion of the form, because I think that's where Mr. Hall's, the nub of his complaint is. Do we end up denying these people their day in court simply because the complaint is not worth hiring an attorney? That's why you folks are the judges. I don't know the answer to that. I know my client will not be upset one way or the other with the decision here. But I think that the statutory word agent is not necessarily by its own terms limited to licensed attorneys. The other side of the issue is if you look at the Ameritech exception, in the Worthington case, is that you now have people configuring their complaints before the Board of Tax Appeals, so much like the Ameritech exception, that of all the cases that came back that were held in abeyance by the BTA waiting on Worthington, they are now taking them. We've had one that I'm aware of in which the school board and its attorney and their treasurer, specifically under oath, went straight to that issue. Was this complaint prepared by the attorney and simply reviewed and signed by the treasurer? And they answered yes to those questions, and the BTA says, all right, we'll hear your case. So I just have to keep coming back to this issue, whether the completion of this form of a complaint is truly the practice of law or not is what is decided here. Now, clearly it's up to the court to say whether they're going to stand on Sharon Village or modify it further from the Worthington case. I know that there was some dissent in the Worthington case about the scope of what has been done here. I can't imagine how an attorney, in fact, could have all of the things. Mr. Hall talks about a special relationship. Well, there is a familial relationship, but I don't know that the law concerning attorneys, in fact, creates any special duty on an attorney, in fact, who is related to the principal. It's nice to have a family relationship because they're trusted and so forth, but it could be a stranger, and we would still be arguing the same position. I don't envy your decision making in this, but that's how we see the issue: is the completion of this form truly the practice of law or not? That's all we have.
Mr. Hall, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you. The issue in this case is simply that. As I read the Worthington case, and as I read the Board of Tax Appeals decision in this case, which brought this appeal, I think they've misread and misapplied the law. And if we look at the decision by the Board of Tax Appeals at page 3, they cite the Worthington case, and they say that this court reaffirmed its decision in Sharon Valley, holding that an attorney authorized to practice law is the only person who may act on another's behalf in filing a real property complaint with the County Board of Revision. Given this decision, we find no merit in plaintiff's attempts to distinguish the above-cited case. I'm not certain that that's what this court held in the Worthington case. I think that what this court held in the Worthington case and the Sharon Valley case and in the Gupta case and in the other cases before that is the Board of Tax Appeals must make a combined determination of fact and law and rule as to whether or not the agent engaged in the unauthorized practice of law. If the Board of Tax Appeals determines that there was the unauthorized practice of law, then rightfully, within their discretion, they can dismiss the case as not having jurisdiction or dismiss it for that reason. But if making that determination of fact and law, the Board of Tax Appeals determines that there was no practice of law, then it still has jurisdiction to hear the case. And as I said in my rebuttal brief, and as Justice Lundberg Stratton and Justice Cook wrote in their concurring opinion, and I agree with them, the focus should be on whether or not the party filing the complaint, the agent, is doing it for fee or for hire or is standing in the stead or in the place of the property owner.
We have a durable power of attorney here. Is there a difference between this kind of a power of attorney and any other kind of power of attorney?
Sure there is. And the actual durable power of attorney here is in the record. And I want to, let's talk first about power of attorney since the court raises it. In this case, we have pretty much an all-encompassing durable power of attorney, which says, basically, I, Frieda Frave, will give you, my nephew, Carl Dorn, the ability to do everything I could do as if present. I mean, everything. And it's all-encompassing. We know that there are limited powers of attorney where a principal can appoint someone as an agent for the specific purpose. And the one we deal with most frequently, if we have a spouse or a child, is to go down and get the driving license or to transfer the title to the vehicle. What I am not arguing is that the conveyance of the authority from the principal to the agent by power of attorney should be determinative of the case. I think, for example, if Frieda Fravel had gone to the individual that Mr. Bridenstine referenced to, or a company such as the court referred to in the Cryer versus Franklin County case, and say, I appoint you as my agent to file the complaint and make the arguments on my behalf in front of the Board of Revision, that's probably the unauthorized practice of law by that agent, even if there's a power of attorney in place. What I'm suggesting is there has to be a taken to the next step. It has to look further, and the Board of Tax Appeals should engage in the three-part analysis that's referenced in the Sharon Village case. Is the document preparation with knowledge not possessed by ordinary laymen? If it is, that's the unauthorized practice of law. Mr. Bridenstine referenced deeds and mortgages. Most laymen don't know how to prepare a deed and a mortgage on their own, so they have to hire a lawyer. The second question becomes, are you given legal advice and instructions of rights and obligations? Merely filling in the blanks on a form is not necessarily that, but making the arguments before the County Board of Revision is that, because you're deciding what evidence to present, what evidence not to present, and so forth. Can an individual do that pro se? Absolutely, because the Constitution guarantees us that right. But for an agent to go in and make those arguments, I think they've now crossed the line. And if you really focus in on the Worthington case and the Sharon Village case, the majority of the analysis in those cases and the majority of the dicta in those cases go to the third prong, which is appearing in tribunals, making the arguments, because there an individual can make the determinations what is in his best interest on his own to do that. But when someone else starts making those determinations on behalf of another party, they're exercising that degree of discretion that rises out of merely performing a clerical task and entering into the practice of law. Thank you.
Thank you. This matter will be marked as submitted, and the parties will be advised of the decision. Marshall, would you please adjourn the court?
All rise. These hearings before the Supreme Court behind